whether you like it or not. She related this dream, and in less than 2 days, she was dead. Chapter 7. Antipas and the Two Agrippas. The territory of Archelaus was brought under direct Roman rule, and a man of equestrian rank at Rome, Coponius, was sent as procurator with authority from Caesar to inflict the death penalty. In his time, a Galilean named Judas tried to stir the natives to revolt, saying that they would be cowards if they submitted to paying taxes to the Romans, and, after serving God alone, accepted human masters. This man was a rabbi with a sect of his own, and was quite unlike the others. Among the Jews there are three schools of thought, whose adherents are called Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes, respectively. The Essenes profess a severer discipline. They are Jews by birth and are peculiarly attached to each other. They eschew pleasure-seeking as a vice and regard temperance and mastery of the passions as virtue. Scorning wedlock, they select other men's children while still pliable and teachable, and fashion them after their own pattern. Not that they wish to do away with marriage as a means of continuing the race, but they are afraid of the promiscuity of women and convinced that none of the sex remains faithful to one man. Contentious of wealth, they are communists to perfection, and none of them will be found to be better off than the rest. Their rule is that novices admitted to the sect must surrender their property to the order, so that among them all neither humiliating poverty nor excessive wealth is ever seen. But each man's possessions go into the pool, and as with brothers, their entire property belongs to them all. Oil they regard as polluting, and if a man is unintentionally smeared with it, he scrubs himself clean, for they think it desirable to keep the skin dry and always to wear white. Men to supervise the community's affairs are elected by show of hands, chosen for their tasks by universal suffrage. They possess no one city, but everywhere have large colonies. When adherents arrive from elsewhere, all local resources are put at their disposal, as if they were their own, and men they have never seen before entertain them like old friends. And so when they travel they carry no baggage at all, but only weapons to keep off bandits. In every town, one of the order is appointed specially to look after strangers and issue clothing and provisions. In dress and personal appearance, they are like children in the care of a stern tutor. Neither garments nor shoes are changed until they are dropping to pieces or worn out with age. Among themselves, nothing is bought or sold. Everyone gives what he has to anybody in need and receives from him in return something he himself can use. And even without giving anything in return, they are free to share the possessions of anyone they choose. They show devotion to the deity in a way all their own. Before the sun rises, they do not utter a word on secular affairs, but offer to him some traditional prayers as if beseeching him to appear. After this, their supervisors send every man to the craft he understands best, and they work assiduously till an hour before noon, when they again meet in one place, and donning linen loincloths, wash all over with cold water. Thus purified, they assemble in a building of their own, which no one outside their community is allowed to enter. Clean themselves, they go into the refectory as if it was a holy temple, and sit down in silence. Then the baker gives them their loaves in turn, and the cook sets before each man one plateful of one kind of food. The priests say grace before meat, To taste the food before this prayer is forbidden. After breakfast he offers a second prayer, for at beginning and end they give thanks to God as the giver of life. Then, removing their garments as sacred, they go back to their work till evening. Returning once more, they take supper in the same way, seating their guests beside them if any have arrived. Neither shouting nor disorder ever desecrates the house. In conversation, each gives way to his neighbor in turn. To people outside, the silence within seems like some dread mystery. It is the natural result of their unfailing sobriety and the restriction of their food and drink to a simple sufficiency. In general, they take no action without orders from the supervisors, but two things are left entirely to them: personal aid and charity. They may, of their own accord, help any deserving person in need or supply the penniless with food. But gifts to their own kinsfolk requires official sanction. Showing indignation only when justified, they keep their tempers under control. They champion good faith and serve the cause of peace. Every word they speak is more binding than an oath. Swearing they reject as something worse than perjury, for they say a man is already condemned if he cannot be believed without God being named. They are wonderfully devoted to the work of ancient writers, choosing mostly books that can help soul and body. From them, in their anxiety to cure disease, they learn all about medicinal roots and the properties of stones. Persons desirous of joining the sect are not immediately admitted. Excluded for a whole year, a man is required to observe the same rule of life as the members, receiving from them a hatchet, the loincloth mentioned above, and white garments. When in this period he has given proof of his temperance, he is associated more closely with the rule and permitted to share the purer waters of sanctification, though not yet admitted to the communal life. He has demonstrated his strength of purpose, but for two more years his character is tested, and if then he is seen to be worthy, he is accepted into the society. But before touching the communal food, he must swear terrible oaths. First, that he will revere the Godhead. Secondly, that he will deal justly with men, will injure no one either of his own accord or at another's bidding, will ever hate the wicked and cooperate with the good, will keep faith at all times and with all men, especially with rulers, since all power is conferred by God. If he himself receives power, he will never abuse his authority, never by dress or additional ornament outshine those under him. He will ever love truth and seek to convict liars, will keep his hands from stealing, his soul innocent of unholy gain, will never hide anything from members of the sect or reveal any of their secrets to others, even if brought by violence to the point of death. He further swears to impart their teaching to no man otherwise than as he himself received it, to take no part in armed robbery, and to preserve the books of the sect and, in the same way, the names of the angels. Such are the oaths by which they make sure of their converts. Men convicted of major offenses are expelled from the order, and the outcast often comes to a most miserable end. For, bound as he is by oaths and customs, he cannot share the diet of non-members, so is forced to eat grass till his starved body wastes away, and he dies. Charity compels them to take many offenders back when at their last gasp, since they feel that men tortured to the point of death have paid a sufficient penalty for their offenses. In trying cases, they are most careful and quite impartial, and the verdict is given by a jury of not less than 100. When they reach a decision, there is no appeal. What they reverence most, after God, is the lawgiver, and blasphemy against him is a capital offense. Obedience to older men and to the majority is a matter of principle. If 10 sit down together, one will not speak against the wish of the nine. They are careful not to spit into the middle of other people, or to the right, and they abstain from seventh-day work more rigidly than any other Jews. For not only do they prepare their meals the previous day so as to avoid lighting a fire on the Sabbath, but they do not venture to remove any utensil or to go and ease themselves. On other days, they dig a hole a foot deep with their trenching tool, for such is the hatchet they give to the novices, and, draping their cloak round them so as not to affront the rays of the god, they squat over it. Then they put the excavated soil back in the hole. On these occasions they choose the more secluded spots, and though emptying the bowels is quite natural, they are taught to wash after it, as if it defiled them. They are divided into four grades, according to the stage they have reached in their preparation, and so far are the juniors inferior to the seniors, that if they touch them, the persons touched must wash as though contaminated by an alien. They are long-lived, most of them passing the century, owing to the simplicity of their daily diet, I suppose, and the regular routine. They despise danger and conquer pain by sheer willpower. Death, if it comes with honor, they value more than life without end. Their spirit was tested to the utmost by the war with the Romans, who racked and twisted, burnt and broke them, subjecting them to every torture yet invented in order to make them blaspheme the lawgiver or eat some forbidden food, but could not make them do either, or ever once fawn on their tormentors or shed a tear. Smiling in their agony and gently mocking those who put them on the rack, they resigned their souls in the joyous certainty that they would receive them back. It is indeed their unshakable conviction that bodies are corruptible and the material composing them impermanent, whereas souls remain immortal forever. Coming forth from the most rarefied ether, they are trapped in the prison house of the body, as if drawn down by one of nature's spells. But once freed from the bonds of the flesh, as if released after years of slavery, they rejoice and soar aloft. Teaching the same doctrine as the sons of Greece, they declare that for the good souls there waits a home beyond the ocean, a place troubled by neither rain nor snow nor heat, but refreshed by the zephyr that blows ever gentle from the ocean. Bad souls they consign to a darksome stormy abyss, full of punishments that know no end. I think the Greeks had the same notion when they assigned to their brave men, whom they call heroes or demigods, the islands of the blessed, and to the souls of the wicked the place of the impious in Hades, where, according to their stories, certain people undergo punishment. Sisyphus and Tantalus, Ixion and Titius, and the like. They tell these tales, firstly, because they believe souls to be immortal, and secondly, in the hope of encouraging virtue and discouraging vice, since the good becomes better in their lifetime through the hope of a reward after death, and the propensities of the bad are restrained by the fear that, even if they are not caught in this life, after their dissolution, they will undergo eternal punishment. This, then, is the religious teaching of the Essenes about the soul, providing an inescapable inducement to those who have once tasted their wisdom. Some of them claim to foretell the future after a lifelong study of sacred literature, purifications of different kinds, and the aphorisms of prophets. Rarely, if ever, do their predictions prove wrong. There is a second order of Essenes which agrees with the other in its way of life, customs, and rules, and differs only in its views on marriage. They think that the biggest thing in life, the continuance of the race, is forfeited by men who do not marry, and, further, if everyone followed their example, mankind would rapidly disappear. However, they put their brides on probation for 3 years and do not marry them till the regularity of their periods proves them capable of childbearing. When conception has taken place, intercourse ceases, proof that the object of the marriage was not pleasure, but the begetting of children. When women bathe, they wear a dress, just as the men wear a loincloth. Such are the customs of the order. Of the two schools named first, the Pharisees are held to be the most authoritative exponents of the law, and count as the leading sect. They ascribe everything to fate or to God. The decision whether or not to do right rests mainly with men, but in every action fate takes some part. Every soul is incorruptible, but only the souls of good men pass into other bodies, the souls of bad men being subjected to eternal punishment. The Sadducees, the second order, deny fate altogether, and hold that God is incapable of either committing sin or seeing it. They say that men are free to choose between good and evil, and each individual must decide which he will follow. The permanence of the soul, punishments in Hades, and rewards, they deny utterly. Again, Pharisees are friendly to one another and seek to promote concord with the general public, but Sadducees, even towards each other, show a more disagreeable spirit, and in their relations with men like